From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The Hulk, Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, the rest of the Avengers will return to Georgia.
What the hell? What just happened?
We won.
We're not finished yet.
No, they're not finished yet. They still have movies to make, and they're making them here. We'll tell you which celebrities you might bump into at the coffee shop this morning. First, though, we asked the Break Room Friday if monogamy really is the best way to go.
I have quite a few friends who are not monogamous. They have very clear rules about what they do, how they do it, how they talk about it, all of those things, and their relationships are going incredibly strong.
That is Robbie Medwed, a Break Room regular. Here are your first thoughts. Zach Patman tweeted at us, "I'm a married millennial. I'm monogamous in respect to my spouse. Plural marriage or an open relationship wouldn't be a big deal for me." Genuine Friend tweeted this, "Polygamy bets irreconcilable hostility between siblings, which is rooted in hostility between mothers. Bad idea to support men's lust." Jesse Bragg said, "Married, never divorced, monogamous over 9 years, and I wouldn't change it for the world." And finally, Paulus Wood said, "I love monotony. I mean monogamy." We love to get your thoughts. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or tweet us like they all did at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. The new home of the Atlanta Braves opened Friday. Fans headed out of the city to SunTrust Park while the team's former home sat empty. Turner Field was purchased by Georgia State University for millions of dollars. Now those who live near the stadium want to make sure redevelopment doesn't drive up the cost of living in their neighborhoods and drive them out of their homes. At least 150 people marched from Mechanicsville to Turner Field this weekend. GPB's Sean Powers was there.
We ain't gonna let Mark Baker turn us around. We're gonna keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up freedom land.
Yeah, my name is Columbus Ward, a People Sound resident for 50 plus years. We're in the Mechanicsville community at the Rosa Bernie Park Dunbar Center. We gathered here to the march to Turner Field on behalf of the community to stop no gentrification, no displacement.
We are part of the fight to save our neighborhood. This is about saving our neighborhood and saving other neighborhoods in Atlanta. Because what they do here, they will do everywhere. We talk about no displacement, no
justice. No peace.
No peace.
My name is Queen Evelyn Clemens, and I'm a resident here in Mechanicsville. With the development that is going on right now, I'm totally satisfied with that. I just want the people to be able to be a part of it.
No justice, no justice.
Since 1964, I was living right here on Windsor Street at the FedEx building where it's right here now. My grandfather Henry Reed and my grandmother Willie Mae Reed was living there, and that was 1964 when I was born. So I want to be a part of the movement. I definitely don't want to be pushed out, and I don't want them to be pushed out just because they're not here to be heard. No, no, we won't go. If you don't help us to fight, it won't be a gas station.
Housing is a human right, not just for the rich and white.
My name is Susan Taylor. I'm here because I have been a member of the People's Town Summer Hill community for a long time. I've experienced several different kinds of urban renewal and gentrification efforts that have never made way for the people who live here. So I'd like to see Georgia State University do in this neighborhood what it says it has done all over downtown Atlanta, which is add to the value of the community by, in this case, making housing and affordable housing available.
No gentrification!
No gentrification! Once those demonstrators made it to Turner Field, they camped out there for a day. That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. If you live near Turner Field, we would love to hear from you. How would you like to see the stadium and the surrounding area redeveloped? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter or on Facebook. We asked Georgia State University's president, Mark Becker, why the university will not enter into a community benefits agreement with residents near Turner Field. They sent back an article from GSU student newspaper, which quotes President Becker, and here is his statement from the paper, quote, "The university is constitutionally prohibited from signing this community benefits agreement. When we allocate money, we have to allocate money for the purposes that was intended, and it goes through a Board of Regents process. There's something in the Constitution called the Gratuities Clause, which states we can't just go giving you state money or our tuition dollars without there being an appropriate university use for that activity, and giving money away to organizations external of the university is not an allowed activity. We don't make donations. We don't make contributions." It's a statement from GSU President Mark Becker, and he goes on to say, quote, "Gentrification is a city issue, not a university issue to solve. We do not set property tax rates." End quote. Gentrification is a hard word to avoid, though, when you talk about a number of Atlanta neighborhoods.
This is historic Soto Sopa. It's our vibrant and charming arts and foods district.
I enjoy how you've retained the lower income housing with the updated and quaint urban developments.
Well, it's a joke on South Park, but not in real life. Joining us now is Deirdre Oakley. She's a sociology professor at Georgia State University. It's good to have you again.
Thank you, Celeste. It's good to be here again.
As a useful reminder, can you tell us what gentrification means, what it is?
Okay, there's many definitions of it, but basically the most commonly used is when real estate developers basically target a neighborhood, and a lot of this has to do with real estate speculation. So for let me just give you an example. As the Beltline is being built around Atlanta, there's speculation about what the property value is going to be where the Beltline is getting built. And so what real estate developers do is that they buy up property, they redevelop it in hopes that property values will go up, which they do. We've seen that around the Beltline, and bring in people that have higher incomes to be in these apartment buildings. And the net effect of this is that you have a dramatic shrinkage of housing that's affordable to people at working class and low income rates. And so sometimes they get pushed out of the neighborhood and have to move somewhere else.
Now, how does that happen? If you already own property somewhere, then it doesn't matter to you what the property values do. Or, as Mark Beck, the president of GSU, alluded to, does that then send your property tax rates up and make it unaffordable to live there?
Yeah, that's part of the problem. And Professor Dan Immergluck from Georgia Tech has talked about this, that if you own a home and you're of a modest income, and property values are going up all around you, you might think that this is a good thing in terms of equity in your house. But if you can't afford the increased taxes, you can have a lien put on your house, and then you can't sell it. So it puts people in a situation where they just can't afford to live there. If you're renting a property and the landlord has to pay extra taxes, it means that your rent is going to go up so the landlord can pay the taxes. So somebody like Professor Immergluck has proposed like a circuit breaker, meaning taxes can only go up so much. But as President Becker did allude to, gentrification is a citywide issue, and it means that City Hall has to get on this, has to be on board to do these things that would mitigate displacement.
Are there other things that developers can do? For example, again, I want to repeat Mark Becker's quote, gentrification is a city issue, not a university issue to solve. We do not set property tax rates. Which is true.
Yes.
Absolutely. But are there things that when someone purchases a piece of property, are there things that a developer can do to try to mitigate the effects of gentrification?
Yes, there is something on the books, and I might not have it completely correct, but I think that in the last year, there's legislation that's gone through at the city level that says developers have to set aside X number of units at some level of the AMI, average medium income, so 60%, 80%, something like that. So it's affordable for people of lower income levels. I would say, though, that that doesn't, the people who are in real need of affordable housing are way below that. They're below 50% of the AMI, and it doesn't help them.
Right. AMI is average. That means there's people who are, a large number of people who are below that average.
Way, way below that average.
So one of the effects of gentrification often is to push out seniors. Sometimes they own their house free and clear. Explain to me why that happens in particular.
Well, again, it happens because of taxes. Just because you own your house outright, let's just say that the property value goes up. You don't want to sell because you want to stay in your home. And let's say it goes up to, you have to pay $7,000 a year. You're on a fixed income. You can't afford that.
And in addition, many people often refer to the businesses, the changeover of businesses that occur, that the businesses that can afford the rise in property taxes are often not those inexpensive places you may have gone to before.
Right. So the thing that people, I don't think people quite understand, is when you talk about gentrification, it's not just about affecting people with lower incomes, it of all ages, actually. It's also affecting small businesses. If they can't afford the rent anymore, they have to move somewhere else.
So what is the, I mean, especially from a sociological perspective, what is the benefit of fighting gentrification? Or is it the kind of thing where you should just allow this process to happen as a neighborhood gets redeveloped, as the value of the property goes up? Maybe that's a natural course of economic events.
Well, I mean, it's part of the market. You're right. And you know, the other thing about Turner Field that needs to people need to be more aware of is that Carter, the developer Carter, is involved in this too. The sale was to GSU and Carter, so there is a real estate developer there that will be doing lots of redevelopment. It's not just going to be GSU, so. Real estate developers, they're in business to develop. I mean, that's what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, do we want to turn into a New York City? All right? So what's going on in New York City?
You mean where the rent is too darn high?
The rent is too darn high. Oh, yeah. But what it means is service workers have to live farther and farther and farther and farther and farther out. And that then has a negative effect on the overall economy of New York City, because you need service workers, and if they have to move farther and farther out, maybe they're going to get a job farther out. Maybe they're not going to commute into the city anymore.
So it's a complete can be a complete turnover in the culture of a city.
It can be a complete turnover, but it can eventually, now this is like years out, it can really hurt the economy.
That is Deirdre Oakley, a professor of sociology at Georgia State University. Deirdre, thank you so much.
Oh, and thank you for having me.
We want to hear from you, especially if you live in that area around Turner Field or another neighborhood, maybe, where a gentrification is a problem. We're having this conversation now on Facebook, or you can find us on Twitter at OST Talk. The Avengers are back, and so is the Unabomber. We're going to tell you what is filming in our state. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On any given day, there is probably a film or TV crew working somewhere in Georgia, but what are they working on? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
Made in Georgia!
We make films.
Movies?
Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
That is your theme music. Jennifer Brett writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Jennifer, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good to see you as always. Let's start with a movie that is going to make a certain number of people, fans of this series, very, very happy.
It ain't about the money.
It's not about the money, money, money. We don't need the money, money, money. We just want to make the world pay. Forget about the price tag. It ain't about the cha-ching, cha-ching.
So, yes, there is a third. Who knew you could turn a cappella singing competitions
right?
into a series?
Mean.
But there is a third movie coming.
Pitch Perfect 3 coming our way, and it has been filming right here in Metro Atlanta. I've seen a couple of star sightings. Rebel Wilson has been making quite the scene during her time here in Atlanta. She showed up at STK and celebrated a birthday at the Painted Pen.
Oh, that's nice. And this one, when is this one going to be done and in movie theaters?
Looking for a release next year. And this one is going to feature not only a lot of singing, but dancing, too. I've seen some social media posts where the girls are really putting their all into this when they're doing a lot of choreography. And so they've really jumped on this with both feet. I wouldn't be surprised to see this be a huge hit. Of course, everybody loves Pitch Perfect, not only for its plot, but also its... It's songs, and so I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, and I feel like that's kind of a feather in Atlanta's cap because it could literally be filmed anywhere. So.
You know, a lot of the scenes for this one, as you know, Pitch Perfect 2, they travel around the world. This one apparently is no different. And so some of the scenes that were filmed right here in Georgia take place in Paris, actually. So, you know, we so fancy.
All right, let's move on to the superheroes coming back to Atlanta. We first saw the Black Panther in 2016's Captain America Civil War.
The Black Panther has been the protector of Wakanda for generations. A mantle passed from warrior to warrior.
That is actor Chadwick Boseman. He plays the Black Panther. There's now the standalone film, which I am extremely excited for, coming out. It just finished.
They're wrapping up now. They have been headquartered out of the Screen Gems EUE studios. Chadwick Boseman, by the way, has been in Atlanta before. He starred as Jackie Robinson in 42. He played James Brown in Get On Up, which was not filmed in Georgia, but set largely here. The Avengers come back this summer for Avengers Infinity War, and then Avengers whatever the next one is called. So it's going to be, they're going to film concurrently. The combined budget of these two projects, which are going to be headquartered at Pinewood, is $1 billion.
Holy cow.
So yes, we're going to see lots of Marvel stars this summer. And just if you want to get out your little sketch pad and figure out where you want to hang out to see some stars, in the past, Robert Downey Jr. has been spotted at Buckhead Diner and also the Costa Coffee up in the Buckhead Atlanta shopping district. Chris Evans and Scarlett Johansson have run by STK. Chris Evans also stopped by Chop's Lobster Bar once, made it rain by tricking out a little dollar bill and making George Washington look like Captain America. So that is dedication to the cause right there. Anthony Mackie, who plays Falcon, is a big fan of Mary Mac's Tea Room. So you might want to stock out those places this summer. Maybe you'll see a Marvel star.
Okay. Now, I don't think anybody wants to be on the road for this filming, but the eighth film in the Fast and Furious franchise comes... I just want to stop for just a moment. The eighth film in this franchise.
Ugh, I don't know. French fries seems kind of appropriate.
It was filmed in Atlanta. The trailer gets your heart racing.
There's thousands of cars in this city, and now they're all mine.
Now I know what it feels like to be every cop ever chasing us. Wait, wait, wait! Ah! Oh, damn!
This is the eighth movie that's just basically 2 hours of car chases.
Yeah.
Thank goodness they filmed it before the bridge collapsed, right?
Well, you know what I was thinking the other day when we were watching all that unfold? I thought somebody is out there with a camera right now getting footage of this highway burning and collapsing because you have to
figure. For number nine.
I mean, you have to figure that could be handy down the road for somebody. Anyway, moving forward. Yes, Fast and Furious 8. This is called Fate of the Furious. It filmed not only in Atlanta, but in Havana, which was really interesting. You know, Havana,
right.
Newly
Havana,
opened and... normalized, so looking forward to seeing all the guys race around the streets of old Havana.
And
maybe.
Women.
Yeah, and those old cars. But looking forward to this one. Comes out April 14th. It's not set in Atlanta, obviously, but a number of the films have actually shot here. The Fast and Furious 5 and 6 and 7 shot partially in Atlanta, so they just love us down here.
All right, so there's a new TV series coming to the Discovery Channel, and it is filming in Atlanta. It is called Manifesto, and it's about the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. Here is actually a real 1996 news story about Kaczynski's capture.
Kaczynski's history appears to mirror some aspects of the Unabomber, whose 16 bombings began in the Chicago area, continued in Salt Lake City, and have since 1987 emanated from the San Francisco Bay Area. The Unabomber's devices have killed three since 1978.
So why, any idea why this one's being filmed in Atlanta?
Probably for the same reason a lot of stuff films in Atlanta, because it's inexpensive. Producers can realize a nice hefty tax credit by filming a movie here, which is why, you know, Pitch Perfect 3, they set their movies in France, but they filmed here in Atlanta. Anyway, this is a Discovery Channel series about the Unabomber. Back in the day, Ted Kaczynski obviously had the nation gripped in fear.
Played by Paul Bettany, excuse me, in the TV series, and Jane Lynch, an audience favorite.
Yes, she's going to play Janet Reno, the Attorney General at the time. This movie, I can share with you a little bit of insight because they filmed with us one day. There's obviously newspapers played a role in this ongoing narrative that the Unabomber.
Do you appear in this TV series?
I can't talk about it, you know, because my people haven't gotten in touch with their people yet. But anyway, they did film a scene at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's press room in Gwinnett County, because there's a key scene that takes place at a different newspaper. And so they needed that, you know, kind of reel of the papers coming off the press. Because if you recall, Kaczynski actually sent his manifesto, hence the name, to the New York Times and said he would quit his bombing campaign if, you know, the New York Times and Washington Post would agree to run his, I think it was like 35,000 word, you know, rambling manifesto about why he was carrying out this reign of terror. Anyway, so they filmed with us for a little bit. I wasn't allowed to film them filming, but they let me watch. And so it was kind of surreal sitting in the newsroom and watching Chris Noth, who plays one of the investigators, you know, rehearse a scene right there in our conference room.
Chris Noth, who played Mr. Big on the Sex and the City movies.
I was like, hey.
Okay, so let's move on to another person who's been cited a lot around Metro Atlanta, and there is a reason for that. A lot of people remember Alyssa Milano from her days as a child, actually, as Tony Danza's daughter on the series Who's the Boss?
What kind of chicken farm is this?
I don't like you talking that way to Mrs. Bauer, either.
I can't help it, Dad. She's starting to bug me. Walk away. Get control. Just remove yourself from the problem. I'll just snap open my little Mary Poppins umbrella and fly off to Goody Goody Land.
Okay, so the reason she has been seen so much is because she and her co-star in this new TV show she's doing are giving people rides to vote.
Yes, Alyssa Milano and Christopher Gorham are in town for a new CW series called Insatiable. They've also jumped into politics in a big way. As you know, the 6th Congressional District seat is vacant now that Tom Price is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. It has attracted 18 candidates. It's a very crowded race. And Alyssa and Christopher have gotten on board the John Ossoff campaign. He is a Democrat political newcomer, 30 years old, a former intern for Representative John Lewis, and a documentary filmmaker. So he is a relative, not anymore, political newcomer to this race. Karen Handel, a former Secretary of State and past Senate and gubernatorial candidate, has taken aim at what she calls the, you know, Hollywood elite jumping on board into this congressional district campaign. So, yes, Alyssa and Chris have been picking people up, driving them to the polls during early voting. The actual contest is April 18th. So, I don't know. We've got all these other stars in town. Maybe they can start giving people to the polls on the behalf of, you know, who knows how many candidates.
Any of the other 18 people that are doing it. But this TV show that they're filming, that is filming currently in Atlanta, which is why they're here. What is that about?
You know, I don't know a lot about this. This is a pilot. And so it's kind of coming together. That happens a lot. You know, on these different pilots will come together. Sometimes they get off the ground and sometimes they don't. But for sure, I feel like their off-screen activity has been almost as exciting as some of the projects that might be rolling.
Yeah. Okay. So last, in the minute that we have left, let's talk about the very last thing, which is an adaptation of the book series Darkest Mind. Author Alexander Bracken was asked about turning her story into movie. And here's what she said about casting.
All of the original people that I had thought of years and years ago when I was writing the book, they've kind of like aged out of the parts a little bit. I also don't like love like planting an idea of what the character looks like in readers' heads. I think the actors who hopefully will get the parts will like nail the character's spirit.
In 30 seconds, can you tell us something about this?
Mandy Moore and Amanda Stenberg star in this movie. It's about this kind of apocalyptic dystopian war where, you know, kids are you know, pitted against each other. Once again, you know, Hunger Games, Fifth Element, and the Divergent series all filmed here. So Atlanta is just home to these, you know, sort of apocalyptic
dystopian
teen thrillers.
That is Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett. She writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Thank you.
See you soon.
Thank you. Atlanta punk rock band The Coat Hangers are now out on tour and ready to release a new EP in June. We talked to them last year and asked them to add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. Now, the rules of the playlist are really simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by another Georgian, and musicians cannot nominate their own stuff. So, here are the picks from The Coat Hangers.
My name's Meredith Franco. I play in The Coat Hangers. We're from Atlanta, Georgia.
I play bass.
Hey,
my name is Julia Kugel, also sometimes Crooked Coat Hanger, and I play guitar in The Coat Hangers from Atlanta, Georgia. The first song we want to talk about for the Georgia playlist is the Subsonics, their song Frankenstein.
They call me Frankenstein, I was designed, my parts out of line, an electric vine. It is so strong that they can't be denied.
I think it's one of the first songs that we actually heard by them, and it's just so cool. It's just really a cool
song.
We
learned how to play it.
Yeah, we did learn how to play it. We were almost going to cover it.
Uh-huh.
Actually, we should.
We
do
should.
That. What
yeah.
are we doing? We got to write these things down.
They call me Frankenstein. I was not baptized. I broke all the Ten Commandments and it felt just fine. Yeah, you thought that you could stop me, but you shouldn't have tried.
It just has kind of like an FU attitude to it. It's like a really great sound. I don't remember what exactly I was doing. Might have been smoking weed. It's a good bet.
It's like a creepy, like...
super creepy and like kind of... Yeah, his voice is really unique. And it kind of like starts off like very like... what's that word? It kind of puts you in a trance. You know, it's like... da, 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 and you're like, what? Where are we going? We're going somewhere weird. I guess I don't even know if it has a chorus, really. It just has, like, a really cool guitar freak-out part. Mm-hmm. And every time we see him play it, it's completely different. And that's one of the best things is when an artist just is an artist. It doesn't put on a show but has their own show, and you're watching this thing that's happening. It's really exciting.
But you couldn't pry your eyes on what you're learning to spy. From Frankenstein. From Frankenstein.
It's really real and really raw and comes from somewhere. You know, it's like Billie Holiday, like, never sang a song twice the same way. It's kind of like that. It's like, oh, whoa. It's like, ah, rad. I wonder what he's going to do now. And it just goes just crazy. It's like, wow, wow, wow.
When I hear it, I'm just like, ah. And I always want to do this for some reason.
Just dancing. Dance.
The second song we picked is the Black Lips' Bad Kids. The Black Lips are based in Atlanta.
Bad kids, all my friends are bad kids, product of no dad kids, kids like you and me.
We are nobody, respect for nobody, play well with others, from all your mothers.
Kind of harkens back to our youth when we would just throw things, you know, and like...
just go crazy.
Yeah, just, you know, throw empty beer cans, and everyone would just go off in a friendly way, but that's kind of what we took from the Atlanta music scene in the beginning, was just being wild. Just the ability to be wild, and no one really was policing you.
And it's kind of like an anthem.
Kind of like empowering song for all the people that grew up with nothing, getting picked on, and then being like, whatever, we're bad kids. We were like, hey, we're from the South. Really good, good people, but if you cross us, you're going to probably get stabbed. And that's kind of the South. The South has a swagger to it, and it's more about the feel rather than the...
You can feel that, like, what everyone has been through and, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, honest.
That was Meredith Franco and Julia Kugel of Atlanta-based punk rock group The Coat Hangers. You can catch them on tour or check out their new EP this June. But if you have a nomination for the Georgia Playlist, we want to hear about it. You can tweet us at OST Talk or connect with us at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Just ahead, walk a mile in someone else's shoes today. Why empathy is not the same as compassion. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, an entire hour dedicated to the world's most narcissistic spy.
No, forget the glass Woodhouse. Just give me the picture. For I am a sinner in the hands of an angry God. Bloody Mary, full of vodka, blessed are you among cocktails. Pray for me now and at the hour of my death, which I hope is soon. Amen.
We'll take a tour through the studios where Archer is made, here in Atlanta, and hear from the voices of Dr. Krieger, Lana Kane, and, of course, Sterling Archer himself. But our question for you is, what show do you look forward to? What show do you never miss? Tweet us at OST Talk or leave a message at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow. At South by Southwest this year, tech experts talked a lot about artificial intelligence and the quest to create empathy. Empathy is a crucial human ability. It's the basis of the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And yet, empathy is not all that well understood. Many people confuse empathy with sympathy, and those two are not the same. So, since this is a term that's used often but is misunderstood, it's time to break it down. Empathy is an ability. Even babies at 6 months old demonstrate empathy.
I love you, Lois. You know that, right? Just in case, I'll say it again. I love you.
Basically, it's the ability to identify what someone else is feeling and imagine what it must feel like. You can try to trigger your own empathy by asking yourself some questions. How would I feel if that happened to me? If I were in the same situation, what would I do? What must it be like to have that job or raise those children?
Bart! Stop fighting with your sister!
She took my glue.
It's not yours, Bart. This is family glue.
Stop it, you two!
Empathy is a crucial skill. It's what helps us realize that a child is crying because it hurts or it's hungry. It helps us recognize grief in a friend or fear in a dangerous situation. Lack of empathy is a key marker of a psychopath.
What about the past? Our past?
We never really shared one.
You're inhuman.
No. I'm in touch with humanity. Evelyn, I'm sorry. You're not terribly important to me.
Oh, no!
Just a few years ago, in 2012, researchers at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine actually identified the part of the brain responsible for empathy. It's called the anterior insular cortex. It's tucked deep inside our gray matter. So scientists have only been able to study it in the years since the MRI was invented. It's why we feel lust, repulsion, and empathy.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I'm not feeling so hot either.
Why would that make me feel better?
I don't know, empathy?
Empathy is often mistaken for sympathy or for compassion. But those three terms are not interchangeable. Sympathy is feeling sorry for someone.
You're the weak one. And you'll never know love or friendship. And I feel sorry for you.
At its worst, sympathy can be pity. But sympathy is really a feeling of sorrow for someone else's pain or tragedy. Empathy is stronger and more intimate than that. Empathy is to feel some of that pain yourself. Not I feel for you, but I feel with you. There's an old Cherokee proverb, don't judge a man until you've walked a mile in his shoes.
Dee, if you're going to walk a mile in my shoes, this is a pretty big part of that mile, don't you think? Now here, put these on.
No, I don't want to wear one of your dirty sleeping outfits.
I'm sorry, Dee, but my outfits, as you like to call them, serve a very specific purpose, all right? This isn't just for fun. I don't have any heating ducts in this apartment. It gets freezing in here at night, all right?
That's empathy. If you take action on that feeling of empathy, or you're compelled to do something to help someone else or prevent them harm, then you're feeling compassion. Empathy could be a momentary feeling of connection with another person. Compassion tends to be deeper, longer-lasting, and more motivating. Therapists will often say empathy leads to compassion. Empathy is an essential component of emotional intelligence. It can be cultivated, nurtured, and grown. You're not born with X amount of empathy. It can increase or decrease over the course of your life. Here are some ways that science has proven can increase empathy. 1. Read a novel. Maybe even a lot of novels.
You found Fanny Price unlikable?
She sounds pretty unbearable, but I haven't read the book.
What?
You don't have to have read a book to have an opinion on it. I haven't read the Bible either.
What Jane Austen novels have you read?
None. I don't read novels. I prefer good literary criticism.
The ability to understand what someone else is going through and to imagine yourself in their position is a valuable skill. Empathy makes you better at understanding other people. It gives you personal insight as well. And it can help you get along with others better and enjoy their company more.
We are not psychologists, though. We do have a couple experts, though, to go through the power of empathy. Dr. A.J. Marston is a professor of psychology at Beacon College. Hi there, A.J.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. Thanks. And Jayhan Exon is a researcher at Georgia Tech's Department of Biological Services. Now, he is here because his team recently published a study that finds empathy can help prevent the spread of disease during an outbreak. Welcome.
Hi.
So, for your purposes, in terms of figuring out what effect empathy can have on the spread of contagion, what was your working definition of empathy?
Yeah, so we wanted to understand individual change effect during an epidemic outbreak, and we know that some of the good old habits we have are avoiding symptomatic individuals or covering your mouth if you're infected.
Yeah.
And The level of empathy we have is the concern you have for others. So the notion we had was, how do you feel if you put yourself in the other person's shoes as a sick person? What would you want them to do, or what would they want you to do? So you kind of, that was the definition.
That
we
was
have
the heard. Definition. And AJ, is that, I mean, without going into specific psychological terms, is that a pretty good working definition, the empathy being the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes?
Yes, that's a great, very simple, straightforward definition of what empathy is.
So what is the less straightforward definition? What kind of more details would you give about the difference, say, between empathy and sympathy and compassion and some of the things that sort of get mixed up when we're thinking about them?
A lot of people do confuse empathy with sympathy, thinking that, oh, I just feel bad for you is empathy, and that's not empathy at all. Empathy is going beyond that and actually feeling those emotions, allowing yourself to feel the emotions that the other person would potentially be feeling. So it's like you said at the beginning, feeling with someone, not just saying, oh, yeah, I feel sorry for you.
And AJ,
so it's going beyond that.
Have you seen some of this research that suggests empathy may be in decline in recent years, say over the past 15 to 20 years?
Yes, I have seen that. I have a couple theories on why that might be happening.
Oh, let's hear them for sure. Is one of them smartphones?
Yes, technology. That's my main theory. It's technology.
So what is the other one besides technology?
Mostly it just, it centers around not spending as much time face-to-face, doing more things in your office or doing more things on your computer, staying at home when, talking on social media instead of actually going out. So it has more to do with less face-to-face interaction, and our society is moving more and more towards interaction that's online, unfortunately.
And that brings us back to you, mm-hmm. because one would think that if there's an outbreak of, say, Ebola or, mm-hmm. or measles or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. that isolating yourself with your technology would be helpful, right? I mean, yeah. that would be what you'd assume.
Yeah.
Why is that not true?
Well, what we wanted to understand was, besides technology, is we have a concern for others, but we're a connected. The epidemic spreads over a network of individuals, which means that if people around me are infected, then I have a concern for others. I have a concern for myself, but if I am infected, then I have a concern for others. And how would I reflect that concern is through empathy. So that's why we call the term empathy.
Oh, so, okay, this goes the other way around. In yeah. other words, if I have the measles and yeah. I am concerned about giving it to other
Correct.
People, I am more likely to isolate myself or take the steps necessary.
Right, so it goes both ways. That's why we have a mathematical model for understanding, game theoretic model for understanding it, because you need to reason about what others are going to do. If I am infected, I would have to think about what susceptible individuals are doing. If they're protecting themselves some way, then I don't need to be that empathetic. But if susceptible individuals or those that are healthy are not taking any measures and I am the only one that's infected, I'm going to cause a lot of damage on the population. So that shows me a level of concern that I have for others, and I have to reason about that. And that the result of that reasoning leads to that empathetic individuals are more effective in stopping disease outbreak, because they tend to stop the disease from the source, whereas if I am risk-averse as a susceptible person or healthy person during an epidemic, I kind of stop the disease from getting to me only. But healthy, sick individuals have a lot more leverage on stopping the disease.
Right. And then does that also translate to the medical professionals who are fighting the disease as well?
It translates more to the communication campaigns that CDC is running, like these good health habits that I started out with. So who should we target as a communicate as a ways to stop a disease from spreading initially to, or stopping the disease or eradicating the disease, right? So it really ties to who should we target and who should we champion. And what this result is showing that we should really champion sick people showing empathy for others, and it will be crucial.
That's the hero, the person yeah. who is sick and yet taking yeah. measures to prevent the spread of the disease.
Yep.
All right, so this brings me back to you, AJ, because this research that Jayan Exon has done along with his colleagues at Georgia Tech is new, but we have seen over generations the effects that empathy can have on a society, have we not? Is there not intrinsic value to empathy?
Oh, definitely. There's lots of intrinsic value. I mean, just in general, empathy helps us create these strong connections with other people, and it brings us closer together, so it helps us develop trust among one another, develop friendships, and even develop love among one another. So when our society can kind of rally together and also empathy towards each other, it builds a stronger, better society.
So that sounds like you're saying that empathy is going to help us no matter what the emergency is, whether it be an outbreak or other.
Empathy is really important, but we also have to be careful with empathy. Take nurses, for example. I was a nurse for almost 10 years. And I saw a lot of great nurses who were really empathetic, really amazing nurses, but at the same time, they would go home at night completely exhausted and burned out because they were almost too empathetic, if that makes sense.
And so there's yeah, frankly, that happens a lot with journalists as well.
I bet.
During
yeah.
times of stress. So, Jayan, this research is sort of a first step, right? I mean, the
right.
next step is to figure out how you...
What to do with that and
yeah.
how to generate
what is
empathy.
For your mind, what is the next step?
For me, it's policy, pointing toward communication campaigns. And so all communication campaigns during epidemics work with limited resources. So a way of targeting, if we know a certain set of people are more infected than others, like a certain set of people are...
How to spend your money wisely.
How to spend it and then spatially and wisely in timely manner. To eradicate the disease. And that's where, and the other thing is forecasting of diseases, which are critical in determining how to spend your money. So we have to account for individual behavior changes during an epidemic to be able to forecast accurately what the disease levels are going to reach, instead of throwing money at everything.
And that can be complicated by fear. People remain quiet. They don't report accurately oftentimes because they're afraid. And AJ, what is empathy's relation to fear? Is it the counterpart?
It is the counterpart. I mean, the biggest benefit of empathy is building trust with other people. So once you develop that empathy and you develop trust, you're less likely to, like you said, start lying about things.
So how do we, AJ, how do we foster empathy in people? I know that many people often think that this is sort of an innate quality. There are those who are empathetic and there are those who are not. It doesn't look like science supports that. In other words, we can increase our empathy, can we not?
Yes, we can. It's just like emotional intelligence. Empathy is part of emotional intelligence, and we can develop our emotional intelligence. The first step is to be mindful of your own feelings. Be mindful of what you're thinking about when other people are talking to you. So if someone's telling you a story and you find yourself thinking about, oh, next I got to go do this, and you're not actually paying attention, you're not going to be able to develop empathy towards that person. So step one, actively listen to other people and be mindful of your thoughts. So, and then second, I'd like to say empathy can be developed pretty quickly just by traveling and experiencing new people and new cultures. Put yourself out there and try new things, and that'll help you develop a compassion and empathetic feelings towards other people that are different from you.
So how effective is empathy? I mean, there are lots of different things that can help during an outbreak, right? Mm-hmm. How effective is empathy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it goes along with one of the things we considered was the connectivity, how connected we are, because the disease spreads over contact with other individuals
usually face-to-face contact.
Face-to-face contact. So how connected in that setting with each other matters. And we show that both of these are playing a role, the conjoint effects of network or how connected we are, as well as the empathy play a role. And if you just have risk-averse or healthy individuals, you can't stop the disease, no matter how less connected or connected we are, as long as the disease is going to, if the disease is going to be spread throughout,
right.
We need empathy. That's kind of the necessary condition that we see.
And it's difficult because somebody's initial reaction might be to totally isolate themselves,
right.
Thinking that's going to stop the spread of the disease, but you're saying it doesn't.
It doesn't. And I mean, we've seen these changes during pandemics like the H1N1 pandemic, where the polls show that 59% of the people were washing their hands more often. And that's a position taken by usually the healthy people. And then there's 55% were committed to stay home if sick. That was a position taken by sick people. And that's really the key that will stop
that you need both sides.
Yes.
That is Jehan Eksen. He is a researcher at Georgia Tech's Department of Biological Sciences. And his research shows, along with his team, that empathy can help prevent the spread of disease. We also spoke with Dr. A.J. Marsden, who's a professor of psychology at Beacon College. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a show for today, but as always, we welcome your comments and your thoughts. Do you think that people express real empathy? Do you come in contact more often with sympathy? What is a major part of your day, and have you seen a decline in empathy in recent days that we mentioned? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Facebook or on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.